This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. We are now 8 weeks or so into spring. Summer is less than a month away, and much of North Carolina is in bloom. In fact, you don't even have to take your eyes off the road to notice it. Just roll down the car windows and slow up a bit, and the honeysuckle or the clover will make itself known. But in some yards and on some roadsides across the state, there are plants that remind us of those guests that never leave. Planted innocently enough, these species are so invasive that they are threatening the native plants. This hour on The State of Things, we're taking a look at what's growing and what's invading North Carolina and what you can do about it. We welcome your calls this hour. How do you know if a plant will be invasive? And how can you have a truly green, green thumb? We'd love to hear from you and your questions. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. And to help us through all this today, we have Carol Ann McCormick, who is Assistant Curator of the Herbarium at UNC Chapel Hill. Welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you.
Well, we should be clear, the herbarium at UNC Chapel Hill at the Botanical Gardens, this is not rosemary, thyme, and parsley.
No. An herbarium is a museum and research collection of dead plants, actually. They're pressed and dried, and they are mounted on sheets of paper that are acid-free and archival and all this kind of stuff. And it's a research collection to document the flora of the southeastern United States in particular, though we do have specimens from worldwide. We're the largest one in the southeast with about 750,000 pressed and dried plants. So we do have not rosemary and thyme, but we have just about every other plant.
Because those would not be native to you.
That's right. Those are European plants for the most part. We have a specimen of a tulip tree from every county in North Carolina and South Carolina. And we document, of course, non-native plants, weeds, but also rare and endangered plants, plants that are new to science. Plants are being discovered and named all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I understand that looking at North Carolina's plants, you know the native species very well, but your concern is on the non-native invasive plants in the state.
Yeah, we also, one function of the herbarium is to track and document weeds. If one looks at a new and up-and-coming weed, such as Youngia japonica, which as from its scientific name, japonica, you might guess it's from Japan, and you'd be right. That plant, if you look in the herbarium, we have very few specimens of it. From the 1950s and 60s, only two or three counties in the state, whereas now if you'd go across the state, you could find it virtually everywhere. So that's one of our functions, is to document new plants.
What does it look like?
It looks like a dandelion. And in fact, in walking onto my building on campus, I kept on seeing this thing that sort of looked like a dandelion, but not really. And once I took the time to actually go over and look at it, looks like a dandelion with an attitude. It's bigger and hairier, and it is all over the UNC campus. Huh? And I sent out an email to botanists across the state saying, have you seen this plant? Please collect it. Please send specimens to the herbarium to document it. And I got emails from half a dozen people saying, I'd wondered what that little thing was in my yard, and I never bothered to actually go out and look. And lo and behold, it was Youngia japonica.
And so are you now advising them to take up every one they
see? Oh, yeah. It's like, yeah, collect one, make a nice specimen, send it into the herbarium, and then nuke them, So, yeah, get rid of it.
Right. Well, some plant, so that is a weed.
Yes,
that's one that's just popped up in the state. But some of these invasive plants turn up in North Carolina because people plant them here.
Exactly. I mean, a good good example of that would be Chinese wisteria or Japanese wisteria, which were, introduced. I mean, the garden trade, if a plant is pretty, people want to have it. And it's vigorous. It grows well in North Carolina, and soon it escaped. One with a lot of these invasive and non-native plants, sometimes there's a good native alternative. And in that case, we actually do have a Native American wisteria. And you can see that in bloom right now on the UNC campus. The arbor in the Coker Arboretum is covered with the Native American wisteria. And the Botanical Garden is selling that. So you can ask for it. And it's not nearly as naughty a plant as the Chinese wisteria.
Well, the Chinese wisteria, I've seen it in tangled trees in the yard.
Oh, yeah.
Before I'd go out there and try to machete it down. But it does have gorgeous blooms.
It has
those beautiful purple blooms.
Yeah, blooms are like a foot long, and they look like clusters of grapes. In fact, a couple weeks ago, I had a lady from North Dakota saying, oh, I see all the lilacs. You know, I never knew they grew so tall, and it took me a minute. I was like, lilacs? She was like, yeah, they're up in the pine trees. And I was like, okay, yeah, that's wisteria.
Welcome to the South. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. We grow them big down here. The native one has much smaller clusters of flowers, but they're the same color. They're absolutely gorgeous, and it's a much better behaved plant.
Mm-hmm. And it can take over the non-native one.
Exactly, yeah. And it can just crawl over and up and surround and basically drown out everything else.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about plants in North Carolina, the natives and non-natives and invasive species. If you have a question about what might be safe to plant or what you might be tempted to plant, even if it's not native, Carol Ann McCormick is with us. If you have a question, the number's 1-877-962-9862. But can a case be, should we be xenophobic here and just pick on the ones that might come from overseas, like that might be
no.
native to Japan or China? Are there not some plants that are native to North America that can be invasive too?
Oh, definitely. Our cactus, Opuntia, was introduced, I'm not sure why, to Australia. And it has become a huge pest over there, so much that, you know, if you've ever tried to walk an Opuntia, it really hurts because it is a true cactus. There is a moth from South America that was introduced into Australia. It is a parasite of Opuntia cactus. They brought it over there to try and get rid of the cactus in Australia. It did very well, got rid of a lot of the cactus, and they could return that land to agriculture. Unfortunately, some cacti were sent from there to the United States, and the moth was inadvertently introduced into the United States, and that moth has been spreading up the East Coast. It was first documented in Florida, and last year we helped an entomologist document the presence of that cactus moth in South Carolina, and it has the potential to decimate our native cactus. So it's dangerous.
Right. Could it take on, say, deciduous trees?
No, it only goes for cactus.
Do we have a lot of cactus that grows native to North Carolina?
Opuntia. There's a...
What does that look like?
Prickly pear cactus. Mm-hmm. And it has beautiful yellow flowers, and it grows out on the coast.
Let's go to the phones now. If you want to join the conversation, 1-877-962-9862. And Younger is with us from Cary. Hi there, Younger.
Hi.
Hi. Did you have a question for Carol Ann McCormick?
Yes, I did. I have an invasive species. It's called stilt grass.
Oh, yes.
And it's majorly overtaking my little parcel of land that has a spring-fed stream running through the bottom of it. And the stilt grass is just horrendous. I've gone online and Googled it, and one of the primary articles was written by a professor at State, and it seems that it has to be controlled in three stages because it continues to reseed itself. However, because of the spring-fed stream, I'm rather opposed to killing it with
Roundup,
because I don't want it to get in the stream. But it's also to the point where it's choking out my cinnamon stick ferns, my eastern wahoo, and my pawpaw trees.
Yeah, prayer is, I think, one very effective prayer and tactical nuclear weapons. No, it is really a big problem. I mean, before I came in, I made a list, and the first plant that came to my mind was Microstegium viminium, or stilt grass.
Yeah. How tall does this grow?
It grows, about knee-high, and the good thing about it is that it's very easy to pull out. It has these little kind of roots. It's called stilt grass because the roots are kind of above ground almost.
Yes.
Very easy to pull out.
You can't cut it with a mower.
No, it kind of gets tangled up in the mower.
It lays down.
it's a real sneaky one. It is probably one of the most challenging invasive plants, particularly in creek bottoms. It likes wet, it likes dry, it likes sun, it likes shade. Pull it every year.
And I guess while you're on your knees pulling it, pray, right, younger?
Yeah, exactly.
I need a large group of people because I have 5 acres.
Yeah, I've got 35.
Let's swap people. Is there any animal that eats it?
Don't you wish the deer would love it?
I do.
I have never seen anything particularly grazing on it. And it's a tricky one because I was out along the Haw River in Alamance County about a month ago, and it was being very rooly. It was only about 2 or 3 inches tall. And then my husband and I went out last weekend, and it was knee tall, and it had obscured all the native plants that were growing below it.
Yes.
Really pulling it is about the only thing that I can recommend, and you've got to get it pulled before it sets seed, and just think of it as employment security, because you'll be doing it for the rest of your life.
Great.
Well, Younger, thank you for your phone
call.
Sorry
to start out with such a dispiriting one.
Can you not just come to love stiltgrass? Or is the problem that it would take up all the habitat for these other plants in your yard?
Exactly. It takes up as much space as you let it.
Yeah. Where'd it come from?
I believe it came from Asia.
And has it been here just for a little while?
It started being a problem about a dozen years ago or 15, 20 years ago.
Okay. Well, continue our conversation with Carol Ann McCormick about plants in North Carolina, both native and non-native, and the invasive ones and the ones you'd like to get rid of in your yard. And if you have that mystery plant, maybe she can answer that if you can describe it well. 1-877-962-9862. Is the number. Later in the program, we'll be talking about those carnivorous plants native to the state as well. Support for the State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Pancava, and today we're talking about the plants that grow here in North Carolina, native or not. With us is Carol Ann McCormick. She is assistant curator of the herbarium at UNC Chapel Hill. We're taking your calls. Our number is 1-877-962-9862 if you have a question about that mystery plant. And we've been talking about the problems of invasive plants in North Carolina. And one person who also knows those problems well is Dale Suter. He's an endangered species biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services, and he joins us by phone from the coast. Thanks for being with us, Dale Suter.
Thank you.
Hey, well, you're an endangered species biologist, but you are concerned about a particular coastal plant that is not an endangered species by any stretch, but has become particularly invasive on the coast.
Right. I am interested in a species that just started showing up or becoming a problem about 5 years ago, and it's called Beach Vitex.
Right. And what does it look like?
It's a deciduous woody vine. It's been planted on our dunes and along coastal North Carolina and South Carolina. And it has green, round leaves that are approximately 2 inches in diameter. And the bottom of the leaves are very hairy, and they have a grayish appearance to them.
Mm-hmm. So this, you know, on first hearing this, it sounds like this might be something beneficial because it grows on the dunes. It sounds like it might keep the sand in. Good for erosion, perhaps?
Well, I think that was one of the original intentions, was that this would be another alternative to stabilizing dunes along our coast. But we're finding that it really doesn't stabilize the dunes as well as our native grasses such as sea oats and bitter panicum do.
And so what's the problem with this beach vitex then?
Well, it grows almost too well in our coastal environment here. It's native to coastal Asia, China, Japan, and Korea, and it has been planted in a similar environment here, but without any natural checks such as animals or disease that might keep it in check in Asia. And it grows very well and is a prolific seed producer, and we're starting to find seedlings scattered all up and down our coast here.
Mm-hmm. Where did it start out in North Carolina?
Well, we believe it was actually introduced by the J.C. Ralston Arboretum at NC State University, probably in the early 1980s.
Oh, and where would they have planted it?
I think the main mission of the Arboretum is to just introduce potential ornamental plants to the horticulture trade. So I think it was probably introduced to some local nurseries in coastal North and South Carolina, and from that point made it into local garden centers, and then landscapers started using it in some of the coastal areas.
I understand Baldhead Island was one, and it's shown up in Atlantic Beach.
Yeah. So far, we've found it as far north as Atlantic Beach and as far south as Folly Beach in South Carolina. But some of the early landscapers on Baldhead Island really seem to like to use this plant, and unfortunately, now we probably have several acres of it on the dunes of Baldhead Island.
Well, I went to a website that you've prepared, or a poster that you've prepared about it. It is a pretty-looking plant, I mean, with, you know, rather beautiful purple flowers on
it. Yeah, it has really nice purple flowers, and it has a really nice odor to it. The leaves smell like eucalyptus when they're crushed, and even if you're standing in a large population of it, you can smell that spicy eucalyptus odor. So it's understandable why folks might want to plant it in their gardens.
But it's of concern to you. I mean, it's very nice to recognize its beauty in that way, but it's of concern to you because you think it's threatening other native plants that are threatened, don't have much habitat as it to start with.
Right. The reason that we're concerned from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's perspective is because of its potential to cause harm to federally threatened and endangered species. And we have a federally threatened plant called sea beach amaranth that grows right out there on the dunes in the exact same place where we're finding beach vitex seedlings germinating.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what's your advice to people? Is it still being sold in nurseries on the coast?
Well, right now we're just trying to get the word out about the species and the harm that it's causing to our coastal environment, and we're doing a lot of education with local nurseries and garden centers, and especially trying to work with the wholesale nursery trade to basically just get this plant out of the trade. And then we're also working to document locations along the coast, and then we have researchers from Clemson University and NC State University's Cooperative Extension Service working on some experimental herbicide treatments to determine which herbicide or which means of treatment might work best to keep it in check.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And finally, if I understand correctly, it's not just a concern for you to the plants, but also to another endangered group, which is the sea turtles.
That's right, yeah. The area where this plant grows, which is right on the front of the dunes, it's one of the most seaward of all plants that you would find if you're walking on the beach. And the area where it occurs is also the exact area where our endangered sea turtles come up to nest. And because the plant is so aggressive, it has potential to even grow over a sea turtle nest just in the 60-day incubation period. So it could cause trouble for sea turtle hatchlings when they come out of the nest.
Right. They have a hard enough time as it is to find their way to the ocean, let alone having to go through a thicket of vitex like that.
That's right, yeah.
So if people were to see this growing along the beach, would your advice be to just yank it out of there?
Actually, right now, we would prefer that folks just let us know where they found it. And we'd like to have somebody come out and just double-check the site. We've had a couple of instances where folks thought that this is what they were looking at, and in fact, they were looking at a native dune species. And so they ended up pulling up or herbiciding the wrong species. So we want to make sure that we're killing the right thing. And then also, we want to make sure that we're doing it in a manner that will make sure that it doesn't come back. It has very deep roots, and it's best if we offer some specific recommendations for removal, depending on the site and the size of the plants and their location on the beach.
So I guess don't try this at home unless it reaches your home.
Right, that's right.
Okay. Well, thank you for being with us today, Dale Suter.
Thank you.
Dale Suter is an endangered species biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He's on the coast of North Carolina. We continue our conversation with Carol Ann McCormick, who is assistant curator of the UNC Herbarium. Carol Ann, it sounds like what Dale was describing there just toward the end about people wanting to do well and take it out, it sounds like there's I keep thinking unintended consequences.
Exactly. I mean, I talked about the moth that was introduced to get rid of the cactus. And there's, you know, kudzu was originally introduced to help control erosion. And now we're trying to figure out how to get rid of the kudzu. So all these things are, when people start meddling with nature, you can have many, many unintended consequences. One thing he talked about, working with the plant industry, that's very important. Dr. Peter White, who's the director of the Botanical Garden, came up with something he called the Chapel Hill Thesis, kind of modeled after Martin Luther, who had 99 theses. Peter only came up with 8. But it's a thesis and a challenge, really, to our sister botanical gardens and arboreta and to the plant industry and to just people who like plants. And it has to do with this problem of intentional introduction of plants. There are lots of plants from all over the world. They're all very beautiful. But should you plant those? And the first thesis that Peter White came up with was to perform a risk assessment for these introductions. If it doesn't set seed, well, then you probably don't need to worry about it. Some things, you know, it's just too cold in the winters. They don't do that well to set seed. They'll bloom, but they'll never set seed, and you don't really need to worry about
it. So they'll make seed, but they will never germinate.
But they'll never germinate, right. And those things you know. Number two is remove invasives from plant collections. You'll walk into some arboreta, and right there in front is a princess tree, which is another up-and-coming weed, a tree in this case, and that thing produces about 8 billion seeds, and it is a tree that's a weed. And you'll walk into a botanical garden, and there is a huge specimen spreading seeds of non-native plant everywhere. Control of invasives in natural areas, and the first caller brought up how difficult that is, and we certainly at the botanical garden are trying to do that. One thing I brought up earlier was to develop native plant alternatives. So instead of Chinese or Japanese wisteria, plant the native wisteria. Instead of Japanese honeysuckle, which is in bloom and smelling really nice right now, plant the native coral honeysuckle.
Does it smell as good?
It doesn't smell as good, but it looks better. It's bright red, attractive to hummingbirds. It's a fantastic plant, and it's native, and it's not nearly as unruly. So seek native alternatives. Don't distribute seeds or plants that will be invasive elsewhere. Our goldenrods, our Native American goldenrods, are a huge problem in other parts of the world. You know, it's not just the Asian plants coming over here and causing problems. Our plants can cause problems elsewhere in the world. So it's wonderful for botanical gardens to distribute plants and stuff, but no, you shouldn't send them everywhere.
Okay. We go to the phones now. 1-877-962-9862 is our number. Michelle's in Wake Forest. Hi there, Michelle.
Hello.
Hi. Did you have a question for Carol Ann McCormick?
Yes, I did. It's about bamboo. Is there any way to control it if I was interested in planting it somewhere?
Bamboo.
No.
No?
I would say take Nancy Reagan's advice and just say no. I would be extremely careful because, you know, you may be very good about, you know, pruning it back and stuff, but think about the next person who lives in your house or think about the neighbor next door who doesn't really care. That is a very, very aggressive plant. It's even tough to kill with Roundup once it gets established. Seek something else.
I've heard people say that there's a spreading bamboo, and that's an issue because then it just spreads and it goes across your lawn or into your neighbor's yard. But that there's also something called clumping bamboo. Is that just like the low-tar cigarette? You're still smoking and you're still getting the health problems?
I'm not sure. I'm extremely leery of just about every bamboo there is. So unless you're planning on having pandas in your backyard to eat it, I'd stay away from it.
Or it's a sure sign you don't like your neighbor.
Well, this is true, too. You don't want to see them. You never want to see, yes.
And you're sending this through the ground to them. Well, good luck with that, Susan. Is there something else that one can plant that would be native or not invasive in North Carolina but still give you that effect?
Screen.
Like a screen. Yeah, that gives you a screen. Other than, you know, a screen of a shrub, is there something that you'd recommend?
Well, kind of planting, if you think of, you know, the understory and you have some evergreen ferns, something like Christmas fern, and then you have maybe an evergreen shrub like mountain laurel, which is a fantastic plant that is in full bloom right now. Think in layers, and between all those, you can usually come up with a more roomy and more ecologically friendly alternative.
Okay. There's always pampas grass, you know.
All right.
Which, I mean, what can people do to take that out?
Because, you know, you plant
those little, couple little sprigs in the ground, and like 3 years later, it's
huge.
As big as your house.
That's right.
And I've heard people use bleach and gasoline and... No?
No.
So literally a backhoe coming in and making sure you get every root?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. John is with us from Apex. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi. Did you have a question or some advice?
Yes, I have a question.
Okay.
I've got something growing in my yard, and it is taking over the yard. And it actually looks like grass. And it comes up in the spring, and it does great in the spring. And it's got these little white, tassel-y seed tops on it. And then by about the middle of June, it looks like it has died. And I guess it's just gone dormant, because the next year it has come back with a vengeance. And it has just taken over my yard. What is that, and how can I kill it?
Well, it sounds like it might be the Microstegium viminium, the stilt grass, because it does very vigorous in the spring, and then towards the middle to end of summer, it does die back. One thing that I can do is you can always bring plants to the North Carolina Botanical Garden. They have what's called Curator on Call weekdays. That's Monday through Friday from noon to 1. And you can call up with questions, or it's even better to, you know, dig up a section, put it in a pot in a plastic bag, and bring it over and have somebody look at it. On Wednesdays at the Botanical Garden and on Saturday mornings, we have master gardeners who come. And they are particularly good, you know, if you're horticultural something or other, your plant has spots on it or something like that. The master gardeners are very, very good at diagnosing problems. Also, you can take a digital photo and you can email it to the UNC Herbarium or to the Botanical Garden. And if you put like a ruler or something in there to show us some scale, you know, we kind of pass it around and everybody looks at it, and we can usually come up with a good identification for you. But I would really recommend that you dig some up, get the soil, put it in a pot, and bring it to a local arboretum, Ralston Arboretum, or the North Carolina Botanical Garden, or Duke Garden, and I'll bet you'll be able to get some help.
Okay. Well, John, good luck with that, and we will put the address for the Botanical Garden on the WUNC SOT website, so you'll be able to find that a little bit later this afternoon after we get off the air. 1-877-962-9862. Is our number. Brian's in Wake Forest. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, welcome to the show.
All right, I'm a lawn care technician. I'm actually working right now. I've been a lawn care technician for about a year and a half now, and I mean, it's gotten, you know, pretty well. I've gotten to know pretty much everything that I'm looking at, but, you know, I wanted to get a third-party, you know, opinion on the herbicides and, you know, the selective herbicides that I am using. You know, so far as, you know, animals, we tell them to stay off, but just, you know, long-term effects and, you know, how it affects the soil, you know, and everything like that.
So. How does it affect you working with it every day? It's another question.
That's another question. I mean, you know, this stuff will get ammoniafied sometimes, and it gets pretty bad. Because I guess with the dirt, you know, at the bottom of our tanks, and that gets ammoniafied, but we try not, you know, we use it up to where it doesn't get to that point, but if it does... but I know a guy who's been working there for about 12 years now, and, you know, they say, you know, no long-term effects, and we do get blood tests and all that stuff.
I would really talk to your county extension agents. They are a really, really excellent resource. I know nothing about pesticides because I work with dead plants. But I would say your county extension agent, and each county has one, and the man for Orange County is always willing and always always helpful. So I would just go to your call up your county and talk to your extension agent because they are licensed pesticide applicators and they're very, very knowledgeable.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, well, Brian, good luck with that.
All right, I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks for listening. You know, we're talking about plants, whether they're native or non-native. I have a question for you. It's, right now we have so much in bloom, but it strikes me that come about July, there seem to be few things that are native that would be in bloom. Why is that?
It's pretty hot, and there still are things in bloom, but they tend to be... there's kind of a dip because then in late July and August we get into the kind of meadow, the open open area plants, a lot of asters and things like that. Right now there is quite a bit in bloom, but there, particularly in people's yards in July, there is that kind of dip, and I think that's why crepe myrtle is so popular because, you know, it can be 4th of July and it's 102 degrees and boy, the crepe myrtle is just doing great. So yeah, there is kind of a dip in those kinds of things. And if you go out in the woods, you just need to look a little bit closer.
They're more subtle.
They're more subtle, that's right.
Crepe myrtles, are they native to North Carolina?
No, they're from India.
Are they really?
Yes.
But they have not become invasive.
No. There are one thing that, you know, people have introduced, and they do really well when you plant them, but they're very well behaved and they don't spread.
Mm. And why is that?
I have no idea.
Okay. It's not like their seeds are everywhere and coming up where people don't want them.
No. Yeah. No. And I mean, it could be that the hybrids that they've developed are sterile hybrids.
Okay. Okay. I have actually seen volunteers come up under some of them, but maybe they weren't the sterile ones. We'll find out. We're talking about plants in North Carolina. With us is Carol Ann McCormick. She is assistant curator of the herbarium at UNC Chapel Hill. Just ahead, we'll have more of your calls at 1-877-962-9862. And we'll also take a look at carnivorous plants. North Carolina is home to a number of species of them, and they seem to grow here better than they do in many places in the world. We'll look at why. And all that is just ahead on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. We are talking this hour about the plant world in North Carolina, native plants, non-native plants, invasive ones, and endangered species. With us is Carol Ann McCormick. She is assistant curator of the herbarium at UNC Chapel Hill. We're taking your calls as well. The number's 1-877-962-9862. Now, the Green Swamp Preserve in southeastern North Carolina is home to 5 different kinds of carnivorous plants. That's more than any other region in the world, we're told. These are plants, the carnivorous plants, are ones that ensnare bugs in their interiors and then don't let them out, at least alive. Perhaps the best known of the carnivorous plants is the Venus flytrap. It grows in very few places in the world. In fact, there's a narrow swath stretching from north of Wilmington to just over the South Carolina line that is the native growing area for the Venus flytrap. Joining us right now is Larry Melichamp. He is a professor of biology at UNC Charlotte and a carnivorous plant man. Welcome, Larry.
Hello, Melinda. How are you?
Fine. How are you doing?
Fine.
Well, we call them carnivorous plants, but we should be clear here that they don't eat hamburger or steak tartare at all, but it's bugs and spiders that they trap.
That's correct. Small things that will fit inside. You don't have to worry about the family pet or small lost children, as sometimes movies portray. The largest of the insects or animals I've ever seen in them would be very small frogs or tiny lizards.
When you say small frogs, how big is that small
frog? Oh, an inch or so. They have been known to if a small frog were to fall in and not be able to get out in a pitcher plant, for example, it would be digested and consumed.
Mm, right. Now, North Carolina seems to have more of these carnivorous plants than most places in the world. Why is that?
Well, it's a combination of factors. This is just a great coincidence of the factors that carnivorous plants need: high rainfall, abundant sunshine, nutrient poor soils, and fire. And those all come together in the southeastern North Carolina, and especially in the Green Swamp. So it's a historical accident, I guess, that the soil is just right and the other environmental factors are just right. And of course, the plants had to come from somewhere. So there again, an accident of evolution that North America produced five different kinds of carnivorous plants that all seemed to be happy down in that region.
And speaking of evolution, the Venus flytrap in particular seemed to intrigue Charles Darwin himself.
That's correct. He thought it was the most wonderful plant in the world, he said. It was sent to him by an early governor of North Carolina, and that stimulated Darwin to want to study it and other carnivorous plants. Then he wrote a book about insectivorous plants, as he called them.
And briefly, what was his theory on how they evolved? Because it is a rather weird, it is odd compared to other parts of the animal kingdom.
Well, he didn't know. That's why he was intrigued. He studied unusual things, and of course back then he did not know about genetics and mutations, and so he simply had to explain how they worked. He could not explain how they evolved, but he knew that their adaptations, their specializations, allow them to survive in the habitats where they live, and indeed by catching and devouring and gaining nutrition from insect prey, that allows them to live in nutrient poor soils where other plants wouldn't be able to live and outcompete them. So it's a competitive thing.
Well, now the pitcher plants, and that's your area of
yes.
specialty. Those are they kind of stand there and wait for the bug to fly
that's
in,
right.
and
like,
they fall down and they can't get out again.
That's right. They're like tall tubular leaves that attract insects with nectar or with colorful patterns. Mm-hmm. And the insects come and they accidentally fall in and fall down into this well, really, and exhaust themselves and die, and then they are digested. The plant secretes digestive juice very much like stomach acid.
But and the Venus flytrap, which is probably the sexier of the
yes.
the carnivorous plants, because it actually it's waiting there.
That's
like
right.
like a jaw waiting open,
like
and then
like a bear trap, and an unwary insect walks into the trap looking for nectar and triggers some little hairs that are down inside, and then the trap snaps shut in less than a second. And if the trap detects protein there, this is what Darwin showed. If the leaf detects protein, it will tighten its grip and begin to secrete digestive juices. If a small stick or rock falls in and triggers the plant, it opens back up the next day without trying to digest anything.
It won't waste those enzymes.
That's correct.
Now, we've said that it's a small part of the world where the Venus flytraps grow.
Right.
And that's in the southeastern part of North Carolina and a little part of South Carolina.
Right.
I know over the years there have been some issues that threaten it. You know, one is people pulling them from the wild and taking them out of those natural places. But there are other issues that
yes,
threaten them?
I think habitat loss is far greater than people digging up a plant here and there. The draining of the swamplands for human habitation and industry, of course, are necessary things, but we've lost thousands of acres of habitat for these and other plants. And so habitat loss has been the greatest factor in reducing the range of the Venus flytrap over the years.
Right. Well, as much as you're an expert on pitcher plants, I understand you had a role in getting the Venus flytrap being shown across the country on the side of a moving company's truck.
Yeah, that was quite an adventure. I think it was maybe 8 years ago, the U-Haul Corporation called me and wanted me to look at some drawings they had made. They wanted to use the Venus flytrap as a feature on their trucks, and of course it was they considered it the most significant thing about North Carolina. This was to represent North Carolina on their trucks. So I looked at their drawings and helped them tweak the drawings and make them a little better and a little more effective. And it was very nice. They were able to show a fly trap and a pitcher plant and actually talk about the Green Swamp Preserve on their truck and on their website.
And now there's a bill in the state Senate to make the Venus flytrap the official carnivorous plant in North Carolina. And I've got to ask, as somebody who favors the pitcher plant in your study, are you going to try to challenge that designation?
No, it's wonderful for the flytrap because the Venus flytrap is more unique. There are 10 species of pitcher plants that grow from Virginia and the Carolinas on down through the Gulf Coast all the way to Texas. But there's only one Venus flytrap, and it is definitely typical of the Carolinas and especially North Carolina. So there could be no better plant, I think, to represent North Carolina, especially in the realm of carnivorous plants.
Great. Well, one other question for you, Larry Melchamp, and also if Carol Ann McCormick, if you could weigh in here. I know that for consumers who would go into nurseries or hardware stores where plants are sold, in the past decade they've been seeing this label on some plants, such as these carnivorous plants, as well as I guess native or wildlife or wildflowers. And it says nursery grown or nursery propagated. Some skeptics, though, suggest that sometimes when that nursery grown appears on a plant, that it might well be something that was taken from a field somewhere, poached, and then plopped in a pot and left in a nursery for a day. And
there's always that possibility, but I'm pretty sure that the vast majority of Venus flytraps and especially pitcher plants nowadays, there are many, many new hybrids of pitcher plants being available. I've actually worked on them myself. Rob Gardner and I at the North Carolina Botanical Garden made a number of pitcher plant hybrids, and we did that mainly to call attention to carnivorous plants and to make them available only as artificially propagated plants so that they would not have to be dug from the wild. And so we're pretty sure that most of the pitcher plants and most of the Venus flytraps that are being sold are truly propagated.
Carolyn?
Yeah, that's a problem not only with carnivorous plants, but also things like trilliums and orchids. Orchids are very, very difficult to propagate. Many of them have obligate relationships with soil fungi, and they can't grow without them. And one problem in all over is, an unscrupulous nursery person will go out, dig them up, grow them in their nursery for the weekend, and then sell them to you. Trilliums as well take 7 to 10 years for going from seed to actually until they bloom. So it's a big investment of time on a nurseryman's part. But one thing that you can do is go to reputable nurseries, recommended native plant sources, and these are places that collect seed or they take cuttings. They don't take the plant out of the wild. They take the seed or a cutting and leave the plant where it is, but then have its progeny. So those are very important things to remember.
That's a good point, Carol Ann. Orchids and trilliums are two of the most important wildflowers that cannot be grown easily in cultivation. So if you're buying a blooming size orchid or trillium, it probably was dug from the wild.
Well, this brings up another issue, and that is just, say, less exotic wild plants than orchids, trilliums, and the carnivorous plants. But, you know,
Black-eyed Susans.
Yeah, Black-eyed Susan or Queen Anne's Lace or Joe Pieweed growing in a ditch on the side of the road. I understand that taking those from such places is frowned upon.
It is. Number one, if it's not your land, you should always ask the landowner. And even if they, if it's along the side of the road, it is better to collect seed or take a cutting and leave the plant where it is. One thing that the Botanical Garden does do occasionally is called plant rescue, where, some huge development is going to go in or some building is going to go in, and they'll go through just before the bulldozers and dig up all the native plants and relocate if there's being a place that's being restored. Take those plants from the plant rescue and put them in a plant that's in an area that's being restored. Those are ethical issues that we all face, and it's better to collect seed or
I actually did that once, and somebody told me that this was frowned upon. And, you know, one also hears an argument that, well, you know, the Department of Transportation is just going to come through and mow everything down anyway, right down to the nubs.
So. Exactly, exactly. There's some Indian paintbrush in Orange County growing along a roadside. And last year I was going to ask the DOT to not mow that area, and didn't happen. And
I had
multiple things happen and didn't happen. So I'm hoping this year maybe I can get to it. But yeah, it's a problem.
Right. Well, Larry Melichamp, thank you for being with us today.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed being there.
Larry Melichamp is a professor of biology at UNC Charlotte and an expert on carnivorous plants. We have time for one more call. John is with us from Raleigh. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Welcome to the show.
Good. Well, I have a couple of, I have a comment for your carnivorous plant guy. One of the best places I've seen the Venus flytraps going was Camp Lejeune in North Carolina, and that's a fantastic place to see them in the wild if you can get on there, and to some of the more back areas of Camp Lejeune. I used to see them a lot when I was in the Marines there.
And I think that's about the northern edge of their growing area.
And there was just loads of them there, and it was always wonderful to kind of be up close and personal with them when you were crawling around on the ground.
wait, you were doing exercises and you came upon a Venus flytrap?
Not exercises, actually just like low crawling through the, you know, training exercises, you know, that kind of thing.
I was on Fort Bragg a couple of years ago, and there's a pixie moss, Pixidanthera, and we were trying, there's a bunch of botanists, and, you know, we were like, please don't drive your tanks on the pixie moss, you know. So, yeah, you do get interesting looks from the soldiers.
Was that persuasive or not?
Having it be named pixie moss didn't help.
But my main question was, now I've got another question, but I was interested in, I'm not a lawn person. I don't like lawns per se, and I was wondering if you could recommend some way to kind of eliminate my grass so that what I'm really trying to do, and this is for my house around Lake Gaston, it's actually in Southside, Virginia, which is in your listening area as well, and sort of almost like North Carolina. But
I'd start small. I'd start small. You know, do it an area at a time. Don't try to do the whole thing at once. You're going to kill yourself.
Right. Can you recommend some plants that I can jot down that I could possibly find at a nursery, or that I could look for that would start growing and take off? I'm not the greatest gardener in the world, so this has got to be stuff that's really going to just take by itself.
Yeah, that's my kind of gardener. Brown-eyed Susans, Rudbeckia hirta, black-eyed Susans, they're great, and they self-seed. Something else, fringe tree, which is a native tree that's in bloom right now, Chionanthus virginicus. It's a wonderful tree, very, very fragrant. Flame azalea, which is a bright orange azalea.
And those are the native azaleas, right?
Those are native azaleas.
They lose their leaves in the winter. And
that's right. They're deciduous, and it's
and they actually have a fragrance, don't
they?
Oh, they're
wonderful.
Because I guess the ones that have been hybrids that we are accustomed to that stay green all year round, I've never really smelt.
Yeah, they don't have that much of a smell, but the flame azalea is just absolutely stunning and definitely native to your area. Purple coneflower, Echinacea, more famed these days for its medicinal properties. Easy to grow, self-seeds, perennial. You know, I mean, that's my kind of plant.
Well, good luck tearing up the grass there, John, and thank you for your call. And Carol Ann, thank you for being with us today.
Oh, thank you. It was lots of fun.
Carol Ann McCormick is assistant curator of the UNC Herbarium in Chapel Hill, and we will put contact information about the Botanical Gardens website on our website. You can get that at wunc.org. Just go to the State of Things page, and we'll have that up shortly. Well, thank you for listening. If you have a comment about a program, you can drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. Our program is directed by Keith Weston and produced by Corey Princell and Jordana Gustafson, with assistance from Alex Granados. Robin Copley is our technical director. Dave DeWitt is the managing editor. And Susan Davis is our senior producer. Support for The State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Melinda Pencava.